Well, actually, I chose this kind of title for giving you a bad impression at the beginning, so that whatever I show that, then you, I hope you'll be better impressed about the powerful of millimetric.
George Bush's debating tactic.
I didn't know that. So I'm not very glad to be in this kind of company, but anyway. Well, actually, I mostly talk about clarions, and I just used the last part of the talk for talking about the results of the millimetric observations. And actually, what I want to show you the kind of spectral windows in which one can observe and study clarions, and the importance of actually. Especially doing some special resolved analysis in the study of clarions in order to understand something more about the physics into the clarions themselves. And at the end I shall present some results of millimetric observation, especially in the case of the club. In the case of the club, I believe that the results are rather exciting, and some results about also G31.5 minus 0.9. My collaborator for the expert of the millimetric observation are Riccardo Cesaroni and Alberto Neri, and the other are mine collaborators for all the silly things we do about clarions. And so all you know what is a clarion is, but just to remind you, there has been 2 weeks ago a very nice talk by Anatoly, so you know a lot of things. And you know that the clarion has an appears like a field center object in respect to the shell-like structure of the classical supernova remnant, and typically in can be recognized in by its flatter radio spectrum, and with higher polarization with a better organized pattern of polarization, and its X-ray emission is distinctive because it's a non-thermal power loss pattern with typical photon index about 2. And in some cases, there's associated parcels. In the other cases, one assumes that there are associated parcels. And, well, actually, a clarion is just a synchrotron emitting bubble. And from this point of view, it's something like a very simple object to study, and this is not actually the case. But, well, in very roughly speaking, we have just to deal with the two ingredients, the magnetic field and relativistic electrons. We need a continuous injection of these, especially of the relativistic electrons, because the X-ray emitting electrons have very short lifetimes, synchrotron lifetimes. And then we need some mechanism of conversion of some energy, that the spin down energy of the associated parser into this component. And well, there is a series of open points that which are not actually details, but which are very important for understanding of these subjects, relating the what is the mechanism of, if there are more than one mechanism for particle injection, and how the evolution of the magnetic field and the particles takes place, and if the particles can interact with the magnetic fields, if there is an interaction between the non-thermal component with a thermal matter which is in the same region, and so on. So for getting some insight on these objects, what are the best spectral windows? Well, the mother of all the spectral windows is the radio, because we, especially for discovering supernova remnants, we have more than 200 supernova remnants overall in the galaxy. About, let's say, 20 are clarions. Depends whether you accept or not some and still doubtful cases. But the characteristic, as I told you before, is a flat spectrum and a high polarization. Also, a sign of the non-thermal emission is the absence of radio recombination lines in radio. The flat spectrum, as well as the amorphous shape, unfortunately create a problem because they can confused with thermal H2 regions. And in many cases, you do have a periodic component into a composite supernova remnant, but its presence is hidden by the much brighter shell component. And on the other hand, the other important spectral window is that of in X-rays. Actually, it's not important for discovering new planets, because X-rays with the Rosetta have been very important for discovering new supernova remnants, but planets are very difficult to discover because mostly of the amorphous shape also in X-rays. But a recent X-ray observation has been very useful for finding periodic component inside supernova remnants known to be previously shell type supernova remnants. And the importance, what's good about X-ray observations of planets is that if you have sensitivity at high enough energies, you can see planets even when you have a very heavy absorption on the line of sight. Well, gamma rays are actually for the future, except for the crab. And let's come to what is in between radio and X-rays. Actually, we have 5 decades in the frequency between radio and X-rays, so it would be very important to fill somehow this gap in between these two regions. Well, the optical is important, but just for two objects. In the case of crab, we may see clearly not only the thermal component, all the filaments, but also the amorphous synchrotron emitting component. And but in general case, you have problems with the high interstellar extinction and with the field contamination by stars. So, for instance, filaments can be much better detected than an amorphous nebula like the case of Pleiadian. And you may see polarization as well. Well, in the infrared, just a few planets have been observed. Observation with ISO put the interesting result for the case of CRAB, 21.5. and the CRAB twin in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And in this case, the positive point is there are no problem with the interstellar extinction. Then there is the millimetric range that I tried to show you, that is not just an extension of the radio window. So you can actually get from this window some different kind of information about at least some of these objects. Well, the first bit of information I can get about the Pleiadian is coming from the integrated synchrotron spectrum. You may see that there are, if you take the case of the CRAB from the radio to the gamma rays, you have regions with different power law spectra and different spectral indices in various regions, since this is the synchrotron emission, indicate that there are different spectral indices in the distribution of particles presently there emitting. The problem is that then in the distribution of particles you have different breaks. So the problem is to understand what is the origin of these breaks. They could actually be breaks related to the complexity of the mechanism of injection of these particles. But what would be very nice to show is that would be that these breaks, or at least some of them, nicely come out from the evolution of these particles subject to adiabatic as well as synchrotron losses. Well, to some extent, in some cases, one can actually prove that. Well, this is the very old model of Pacini-Salvati, then used also from us and from Reynolds and Chevalier and other people. And this kind of model, that actually is not a real model, it's actually a tool for a sort of a diagnostic tool, because it has some sort of inconsistencies, internal inconsistencies. It actually based on very simple assumptions. We have a bubble which is uniformly filled by magnetic fields and relativistic particles, and these particles are injected with a power law spectrum, and then one may follow the evolution in time of the magnetic field and of the particles by assuming some efficiency in the conversion of the pulsar energy losses into magnetic field and particles, and taking into account the adiabatic losses due to the expansion of the periodic nebula, as well as synchrotron loss in the case of particles. If there is an input, a constant input of energy, then there is a typical energy at which there is a balance between the adiabatic and the synchrotron losses, and one may easily show that one expects a break in the an evolutive break into the distribution of particles, and then into the emission of photons. And what is distinctive of this break is a change in the power law by a value 0.5. And this is the simplest case. If we have an evolution with a switch off of the pulsar, or a decrease in the power of the pulsar itself, then you come out also with the second break, which is a fossil break coming out, and which is typically at frequencies smaller than the real evolutive break. I'm telling so because things works very well, at least at first sight in the case of the crab. They don't work so well at the second sight, and as well in for other objects. In the case of crab, you may see that a lot of numbers match very well together. We see that the total energy lost by the pulsar is actually is of this value, and the present losses of the pulsar match very well the luminosity in X-rays, basically because the particle injected right now in X-rays are emitting efficiently. Then if we take the spectral break in the crab, the main spectral break in between radio and infrared at 10,000 gigahertz, you may infer a magnetic field which is consistent with the other ways to determine it, and that gives a magnetic total magnetic energy which is comparable with the energy loss from the pulsar itself. And we may see that then that the energy losses of the pulsars are somehow well divided into a magnetic field and particles, and well, this is the case of the crab, but it's not obvious that this kind of equipartition is common to all pleurions. Moreover, one may compare the spectral index in radio with that in optical, and see that the difference in spectral index is very close to the factor value 0.5 that is predicted by the theory. And also the spectral variations in radio can be well described.
Question.
Yeah.
Can you, in principle, tell anything about the composition of the pulsar from the ratio of the synchrotron luminosity to I omega mega dot? The two numbers were close, but they weren't the same.
Well, they weren't the same, and if you use then a model with some more physics inside, you may see that actually the two numbers are not so close at the right at the beginning, but may become close because of interaction into the nebula itself. I'm going to the what are the Kellner and Koronecki models and a model of this kind. I come in a while to this point. I was just using this kind of simple reasoning for saying that in this way one can actually have some sort of diagnostic tool for giving first impression determination of what is the magnetic field, what is the magnetic energy, and so on, in a planarium, just starting from easy to observe quantities. At least the age of the planarium in some cases known, but in other cases can be inferred in by kind of reasoning. And the problem is that if things are not going well, one may wonder if what we see in the spectrum as a spectral break is actually the right spectral break, and whether it is good to use that break. Alternative could be that a break that we see is intrinsic in the injection, or is the fossil break I mentioned before. And a bad situation is the case, for instance, of what we call non-crab-like planarians, basically planarians in which the spectral break is seen at very low frequencies, just slightly above the radio, on high frequency radio range. And in this case, having such a low frequency for the break, it means that you have a rather high magnetic field. And especially in the case of CTB 87, if you just blindly take these numbers, you come out with an energy magnetic field which is exceeding by far that of a supernova itself. So there is something wrong when we play with these objects, the same kind of equations. And probably in this case you are looking at the fossil breaks, but there are also some details in on the sharpness of the break and so on that do not fit well in this kind of.
What's known about the red? So I'm absolutely ignorant. For CTB 87, what's inside?
Well, there is nothing visible inside. That's a pretty large planarium, and so it has a big volume. From this, you can infer a rather big magnetic field, and then you come out with a huge magnetic energy. So that means that something can be wrong in this kind of determination.
But if I wanted to be only slightly radical, why couldn't I say a magnets are born in a millisecond?
Well, I mean, you could do that.
Christmas,
Christmas,
so I think I satisfied some constraint.
The point is that philosophically speaking, try not to go towards too exotic stuff unless I am really obliged to do that.
No, but I mean, but your argument is only because that number is big.
Well, yes. The point is that my argument that this number is big because this kind of theories, this kind of formula used, are wrong, and they have not been used properly. So that's the much simpler and the kind of explanation in this case. Maybe you're right.
Is there gamma ray data on any of that? I mean, the other way to get into the...
No, not as far as I know. But gamma rays data are just for the crab. For some pulsars, for some pulsars, just this year, a paper appeared in which they try to infer that part of the unpulsed emission can be related to an associated planarium. But for telling things like that, yeah, the only planarium that has been observed in gamma ray by now is the crab planarium. Well, so just to say that for these objects, things are strange, and these objects are a kind of object that deserve. One of them is 3C58, in which there is a spectral break at 40 GHz, and this kind of object deserve a better study. And this is one of the reasons why we went with the observation of magnetic wavelength, was also to observe this kind of objects, because if you go, you have information on what is going on here, imaging on this side. If you have imaging on the other side, you may try to see if there are changes of the spectral break depending on the position of the pair itself, and that could give some more information about what is the origin of this break. Well, and now let's come back to the models, and these are better models. I'm sorry to say that, because I was part of the other models. These are more physically, at least they are more physically self-consistent. And they start from a model proposed by Risa and Gana, and by Ken and Coroniti, and by other people in different ways. But here the basic ingredients are the following. You have, again, the pulse. You have a relativistic wind from the pulse. And that's wind of done of magnetic fields, which are mostly toroidal, and relativistic particles. And at the boundary, you have a low, by relativistic standards, velocity surface, which is expanding. And, well, if you take these ingredients and you put them together, you find basically the following thing, that there is a formation of a strong termination shock for the wind, and at the position which the run pressure of the wind is similar to the pressure in the nebula itself, this is produced by the previous energy input of the pulse, and this is the run pressure of the wind itself. And from this you can derive that this termination, the ratio between the radius of the termination shock and that of the nebula itself, it's related to the ratio between the outer expansion of the nebula and the speed of light. And this is the size at which more or less wisps are found, at least in the case of CLAB. And another finding of the models is that things can go well only if this pointing sigma, which is the ratio between the pointing flux and the particle energy flux, is much smaller than one. So you must start with the wind, which is particle dominated, because otherwise you cannot slow down efficiently this MHD flow down to the outer velocity. And these are the kind of profiles that Ken and Coroniti found. In the case of small sigma, you have, just after the inner shock, the termination shock, you have a rather fast MHD flow, which is slowing down considerably while reaching the final the expansion velocity of the nebula as a whole on the outer edge. And so the velocity is going down considerably, the magnetic field is going up and then is somehow going down, and here's the answer to your question, I guess. Basically, the equipartition between magnetic component and particle component is not present just after the termination shock. But since you have a compression, you come out with the ordered magnetic field getting more and more importance with respect to the particles. And then you more or less reach a partition on the outer part of the nebula itself. So things seems to go very well, because if also make the minimal kind of assumption on the injection of particles, just take a power law injection with a given energy range, you need both an upper and a lower limit, but you can fix everything by using the jump equation at the termination shock. And you find out that synchrotron losses are not very important in the inner region of the plane itself. For me, the plane is everything beyond the termination shock. But in the inner region of the plerion, you have fast velocities, so small expansion times, and a low magnetic field. So for this reason, you may have that even X-ray emitting particles are not efficiently losing synchrotron by synchrotron mechanism. And by a fit to the X-ray spectrum, actually this model can derive all the basic quantities of the original wind, the quantity sigma, but also the this the for velocity of the original for velocity of the wind, the luminosity is taken as that of the Crab pulsar, and the used radius is that of the well, actually the radius is derived is consistent with that of the wisps. And in order to see how well these models behave, actually let's start again criticizing ourselves, because we have taken the Elena Mato took the prescription of the Pacini and Salvati model and tried to put the space inside in order to see in which way one can derive some information about the spectral profiles. See? Yeah.
Rino, what is the definition of inner
perion? The inner perion is what is just outer of the termination the Stannis termination shock. So this is my definition. So it's where basically in the Kenner Koroniti model I have values of the magnetic field and of the velocity which are consistently different from the average values into the neighbor itself. And then, well, this kind of model cannot is not been as a negative or positive point. The negative point is that it is not self-consistent dynamically, because one can make an assumption on the magnetic field. For instance, one can use the magnetic field constant in space and show you the consequences in this case. But it does the advantage that it can deal with the time evolution of the supernova remnant, while the Kenner and Koroniti model is in a steady state situation. And by using basically the flux conservation, magnetic field flux conservation, one finds out that if you have the magnetic field which is constant in space, you start with velocity which are too slow. If you start with velocity which are too slow, you burn efficiently the electrons that were emitting at X-rays, and basically you come out with a size in X-ray in optical which is much smaller than this is the frequency. This is much smaller than actually observed. So in order once you fix the size in radio, so basically the result of the Kenner-Koroniti model that the magnetic field is small and the velocity are very fast in the inner part of the plerion is actually something that you need if you didn't find that you have actually to put into a model in order to have reasonable sizes also in X-ray and in optical. Well, one in the past, yeah.
Do you assume that all of the spectrum is injected at the shock? I mean, all of the particle energies
well,
are eventually radiated.
Yes, well, the point, what you are trying to ask, if I understood well, as I understand well, is that you may have a further source of injection of particles. And that could actually be...
That will expand your...
Yes, and that could be a point. Another point is that if you can preserve some particles without efficient singleton emission until they reach some outer part of the nebula, and then this could be actually done by playing with the pitch angles, because we assume that pitch angles are isotropized very efficiently, but we don't know that. And the efficiency by which the pitch angles of particles can be isotropized depends on what is the level of turbulence into the nebula itself. So there are these open points, yes. And you may have another possibility is that you have diffusion, diffusion in a generic sense, because we don't have any strong reason for having diffusion just as we know that. And by the way, this is the presence of generic diffusion is not very well consistent with the recent observations, because if you, for instance, take, let me just show you this image, the case of the Crab Nebula as imaged by Chandra, you may see here that you have a very sharp boundary. So if you have, generically speaking, diffusion, you should not expect any kind of sharp boundaries in this object.
Is that sharp boundary? I thought there was a sort of molecular or dense atomic edge. I thought that was an absorption edge rather than a...
Oh, ah, you say if it's absorbed by, from something.
I think there's a dense optical filament over that position.
Sorry?
I thought there was a dense optical filament just around that position.
Not as far as I know. Because, by the way, I would say that this is somehow related with the direction of the magnetic fields. So, if you have diffusion, if I may use the word diffusion, diffusion is very inefficient orthogonal to the magnetic field.
Yeah, but you're quite sure it's not absorption, because I thought there was a paper by Hester or something explaining that due to foreground absorption, the X-ray.
I don't remember. Well, you say that because you have the paper of Hester based on Rosette data.
Well, yeah, it was Rosette plus HST optical and various things.
I don't have in mind this kind of statement by Hester. I should check that. But I think that if you have something, some kind of absorption, it should have been seen with Chandra, because with Chandra you may have you have a spectral resolution, so you may still see the hard photons there. So let's come back to the radio profiles as derived by Ken and Corniti. And what one finds is that actually you have that at high energies, at high frequencies, the size of the nebula is smaller. These are radio profiles. And moreover, you see that when synchrotron emission is important, you have a sharp boundary. And that can be translated in a steep spectrum near the edge of the nebula itself. And this is something that we should keep in mind for the next view graphs. And moreover, a problem, weakness of this model, as you explained very well, what's going on from optical to hard X-rays. But you cannot explain the radio emission that is seen in the Crab Nebula. And in planets in general, because in the radio emitting photons, electrons are very low energy electrons, but they are quite a lot of electrons. So when you start with a model based on a wind, you have a given amount also number of particles. So you cannot exceed the flow of particles in order to explain what is seen. Unless you assume that in the past the production of particles was much, much larger than it is right now, or that we have independently another mechanism of production of particles. But it's very difficult to reach the latter conclusions unless you have very good reason for doing so. It's not just because the models do not work properly. And let's come back to the radio profiles in X-rays. Well, actually, if we look at the radio profiles in some planes, we do not see the kind of profiles that we saw in the model. So we do not see a sharp edge with a steep spectrum on the edge. These were radio profiles of the photon index with 3C58 that do not see that, but here we have problems of spatial resolutions. But in the case of observation of G21.5 by Chandra, definitely there is a central part with a spectral index This is energy spectral index of minus 0.5, and we have a plateau with a spectral index of minus 1, but actually you don't have anything that looks like a sharp change in the spectral index. But you have instead this kind of smooth transition from one part to the other, like you should have two components. And that could be a suggestion that we actually have to deal with more than one component in some clarions. In order to study what's going on, we should actually rely on spectral studies with a spatial resolution. Because they can give a lot of information. And basically, we start in the case of the crab. There is an observation that is actually favoring the idea that we have just a single component of emitting electrons, at least in radio, because if you look at the map of the spectral index in the radio, it's unbelievably flat, so there is it's a really boring matter, because it's the change in the spectral index are less than 1% all over the remnant, except for the part very close to the wisps and probably something near at the boundary. The situation is very different if we go to the optical, and that's a work by Veronsetti and Volcher, and they show that the spectral index changes from the center to the outer part, and there is a central part in which the spectral index is rather flat, and with a spectral index of minus 0.5, 0.6. This is optical, and this is the white part, and the spectral index is steepening down, reaching about one on minus one on the outer edge. And what's also interesting is that the shape of the flatter spectral index component is similar. Can you see that? To the shape, overall shape of the crab in X-rays. So we don't know what's the reason of that. In a qualitative way, one would expect anyway to have a steepening of the spectra on the left side, but this correlation between the size of the inner part and X-ray plerion is not very clearly understood. Actually, we did some further work on this sense by taking a lot of rosette photons in order to have a very deep map of the crab plerion, and we, in order to do that, we have to subtract the halo due to interstellar dust, and we come out with an image. Here it's filtered by in order to show at the same time the very faint stuff and the very bright one, and we see that there is some X-ray emission from a region which is of a size comparable with that of the optical.
I'm sorry. Yeah. This is
Rosette data. There are worse of the Chandra data as far as spectra and spatial resolution are concerned, but there are so many photons. So if
what's the contrast in this halo? I mean, there's a response function for the wings of the telescope. So what's the contrast?
Yeah, it's not just for the wing of the telescope, because these here you may see the point spread function that we have used. This is logarithmic, decimal logarithmic, and this is the response function of the telescope, and this is the halo that we added by assuming a power law that can be well fitted on the outer part. And if we do that, the contrast we can get is what you see here. Here I have a split that the all the image in taken various pixels that they are 4x4 arc second pixels each point, and then you may see the flux in X, which is actually going for about five. I mean, here we are dominated by the noise, but you are going for four and a half decades from the brightest point to the faintest ones.
And what's the extinction?
You mean extinction in optical, in X-rays?
Well, I guess I'm worried about is dust halo, the dust scatter.
Well, I mean, you have an extinction corresponding to 3 times 10 to the 21 centimeters to the minus 2.
Okay. So could this be from the dust along the line of sight? So there's also halos, there's always halos seen if you look because of...
But there are always errors due to the dust, which is along the line of sight. That's true.
So this is much bigger than that effect. You know, this isn't just a halo from the dust scattering along the line of sight.
Yes, this is the error due to the dust scattering along the line of sight. And but in these points, we have taken away this effect at the best as we could do, and that is just to well. This is these boundaries of the pattern that you see with Chandra is like this one, but this is real X-ray flux, and you may play a little bit by comparing this with what you see in optical. You may, for instance, see that when you have you can actually compare the average spectral index between optical and X-ray, which is actually the ratio between the two, and the spectral index in optical, and you may see some shape that you can try. You may try to interpret in some way. We did that, but for purposes of time, I'm not going over on this point. But the basic point was that. We found very likely that there are some observational suggestion in evidence in favor of more than one component, and we see different kind of spectra if we go to the central torus to some sort of belt which is more extended in the equatorial. Region of the Crab Nebula, and some different spectra from optical to X-ray if we go to the two polar lobes, just a continuation of the jets of the Crab. The problem with all this kind of studies is that you always have to deal with the downgrading by synchrotron losses. So the important point would be to see some variations in a frequency range in which you don't have to deal with synchrotron losses or just a little bit with them, because in that case you may say for sure that these variations are related to more than one component of emitting particles. And this is the reason why, one of the two reasons why we started with the magnetic observations. And one reason was that trying to see if there are special variations in the break frequency in the Pleiadians with the low frequency break, and the second was to try to test special variations for Pleiadians in general, and especially in the case of Crab with the 30-meter telescope at Iran, and we have some nowadays some results on the Crab Nebula and G21.5, and well, in the case of Crab, the situation seemed in principle was desperate. Because the Crab is a branch of being a very easy object to observe, but we have what was known from the radio that there was no variation in the spectral index, and moreover, the overall break of the nebula, it's at 10,000 gigahertz. So observing at 230 gigahertz was not to approach, like approaching really the break. And moreover, we could have a problem with the dust emission that is seen in this range. But anyway, these were the previous observation, millimetric observation. This one was the previous millimetric observation of the crab. So it was worthwhile to try to do something better. And these are our results. This is the map at 1 millimeter. This is the map of 1 gigahertz downgraded to the same resolution. And this is the spectral index map. And we do see some variation of with a range of about 0.05 in spectral index. And what I want to convince you right now is that these variations are real, and they probably mean something that could be also rather important. So this is again the map in grayscale. But and if you look at the map of the spectral index, we see that there are some regions which are not with a concave spectra, but some regions which have a convex, sorry, not with convex spectra, but with concave spectra. So we have an excess of flux in millimeter peak wavelength with respect to the extrapolation of the radio. So we play the trick of subtracting the extrapolation of the radio emission to 1 millimeter, 1.3 millimeters, and this is what is remained. So we have some noise, we have some small black part, and we have this bright part near the center. So what I want to convince you is that these, but also these features are real. And let's start with the center feature.
The black levels aren't below zero, is that right? Are the black levels below zero?
Below zero with respect to the extrapolation from the radio. So in that case, that would be, if you believe in those blacks, that means that you have a spectrum, a local spectrum which is bending this way. In the other case, you have a spectrum which is bending in the other way, so we took that as a further component. Well, the interesting thing is that this component is has a shape, and I hope that you will agree somehow with my feeling, is that a shape, this is the millimetric window I promised you, and I just put these two crosses in order to give you the position of the pulsar, and to compare the position of the four images. Here we have the radio image downgraded to the resolution we have at 1 millimeter. This is the residual part, and this is the excess of flux. This is the region in optical in which we have a flatter component of emission optical, and this is the map in X-ray. So one may agree or not, but the shapes of this and the size of this component seems rather similar. So from that point of view, one could say that these components could actually be at different wavelengths the same component, but in this case we came with the problem that this size is unrelated with the synchrotron downgrading, and especially in this case we have something in which the synchrotron losses are secondary. If we take the excess we see in at 1 millimeter, actually from in the total luminosity spectrum, we see that It doesn't seem very much higher with respect to the other points of the spectrum. But we must remember that this component is a component that you clearly see in the map. And so we try to fit a spectrum also to this component. And this is a classical synchrotron spectrum plus the dust emission. We have played the serious trials. First of all, this cannot be a free emission because you need about 50 solar masses of material that you don't have there and then could then give a free absorption at longer wavelength in radio. But you cannot have a Kamen-like situation. This is a second dust component because you would really need a dust component which is really very cold, unbelievably cold. So we you have problems with the standard pleionic synchrotron model because here you have zero index, here you have one index, because in that case you would have this component to be important also in the radio, and therefore you could not get the very flat map in a spectral index in radio. If you just try with a single component of particles, I mean, even if a single in this case of a single component, I have just the single particle synchrotron spectrum, you can get some reasonable result. You can have a model that's passing through this point and doesn't give too much problems to this to the radio. So that gives says that if you want to fit empirically this further component, you need a distribution of particles with a cutoff at the lower end. And if you want to play a really good trick game, so you say, well, I have also the flat component in optical, so make this component emerge also in optical, and you come out with a component with a spectrum of minus 0.5, and then with a cutoff in the emitting electrons. And you come out with the number, total number of electrons, which is not so different from what is obtained by Kennedy Coronetti. This is in the case of the optical, just to remind you, the spectral index map transforms into the sum of two components. This is the component that we are interested in right now, and this is the overall shape of the nebula. And so the result are the empirical result of the following: we find a variation in spectral index, get the photometric point which is above the extrapolation, and we have tested the various possibilities, and we come out that the most likely possibility could be the distribution with the cutoff on the lower boundary and the power law elsewhere. And the number of electrons are more or less consistent with what predicted by Kennedy Coronetti. And moreover, we have the black part that I showed you before, and they are related in position with the position of filaments in radio, and they show some spectral bending with respect to the filaments that could be interpreted in terms of the lower black frequency in those regions. So in radio one doesn't see variations in the spectrum, but if you go at higher frequency than the radio, if the black frequencies are smaller in those filaments, you may find this effect. And actually, it's not clear what does it mean in terms of the magnetic fields inside these filaments, because it depends on what is the evolution of the particles there. Because if the particles just have a uniform distribution through a nebula, then in order to have a smaller a frequency, you need a smaller magnetic field. If actually the particles are trapped into the, into that magnetic field, the signal losses are higher, and then you come out that smaller black frequency is related to somehow larger magnetic field correlated with the filaments. But, well, for this second component, there is some general agreement with the Kenner Koroniti model, but by discussing with Anatoly, with Andrea, with John Arons, we found that there are more problems than nice results for the theory, because there's a problem that the Kenner Koroniti model predicts very low radiative losses in the inner pleurion, and actually some low radiative losses are needed in order to preserve the size in X-rays. And so one may wonder why the size in millimetric wavelength is similar to that on the X-rays, on the bulk of the X-ray emission. And moreover, if one may wonder, well, if this distribution that therefore cannot be due to synchrotron downgrading was already intrinsic at the injection of these electrons, that may be. But then we come out with a second order of problems, because in the plane parallel advective model, these electrons have a long lifetime. And therefore, one may wonder why they didn't almost reach the boundary of the Crab pulsar, but they just stopped somehow at half the way. And so there are possible way to path to follow, but actually there is no model yet that could explain this kind of information, but this observation are real, in the sense that I'm convinced that what we see is something real. We have just to interpret that. I want just to finish with something on G21.5. I do a study very short, in the sense that G21.5 was one of these objects of these pleurions with the low frequency break. And actually, this low frequency break, 40 GHz, is not found by our observation, because these are the previous observations from which the 40 GHz break was inferred, and this is our observation. But especially if we take the whole spectrum, also with the infrared data from Galland and Tufts, we find that our point is unbelievably well fitting the whole spectrum, while the other ones are below. So I think it's likely that these they had some problems. They are pretty old measurements, and this has been misinterpreted. We have also a map of this object, and we have also been able to produce a map of the spectral index by comparing that the map at 22 GHz. But there are spectral variations that I don't know whether are real, and especially I don't know what do they mean. But this object is more roundish, but with some sort of bilateral structure. So it may likely it could be that one size has a slightly different history from the other ones. But what is interesting is that one may compare the radial profiles in radio, 23 GHz, with that at 230 GHz, and we do see the beginning of the shrinking of the nebula itself. So actually, models should actually try to get information about the final motion of the electrons in the outer part of the nebula, by fitting these two profiles in comparison with the shape of the overall spectrum. But I would say that as a first guess, the fact that you have actually shrinkage means that the break we do see, not at 40 GHz, but about more than 1,000 GHz, is actually a real break, at least in this object. Thank you very much.
How do you determine the error bars of the
data? Well, we determine the error bars in a very pessimistic way. So, because...
very accurate?
Yes, because actually our... I'm not the observer, but... this is the error bar that we determined, but actually if you look at this dispersion between I don't have it here. We use an error bar of 10% of error, but we have five different observations, and the dispersion between the different observations is much smaller than 10%. And we may, the problem is that there could be some systematic errors. On the other hand, these observations have been done by using a single bolometer. This is a bolometric observation, which you observe the source and the sky, the source of the sky. And this is done in the same way, but instead of having one bolometer, there is an array of bolometers, and all of them passing through the object. And each bolometer observes the object. So a result of all the bolometers are compared in the same period of time of observations. So if there is something wrong with some part of observation because of weather condition, can be understood from the discrepancies between various bolometers. If there is a bolometer which is not working properly in that condition for technical reason, one may find that. So basically, I feel that the error bar are smaller than that, but these are the error bar I've been allowed to use.
What I meant is area graph.
For the Crab Nebula?
Yeah, Crab Nebula, yes. Because you had only a few points.
Yes, well, in that case... Well, actually, in this case, the error bar is even larger. Because in this case, we have a very bad source, but we must remember that this is... also in this case, there is this 10% error bar. I would say that the error bar is somehow smaller because...
The maximum error bar you are showing? The maximum error bar?
Well, it's difficult to say because this is a non-standard kind of data analysis. So the error bar that I've been given of 10% is something that can safely say that we are away from all bias related to the kind of procedure which is working since various years, but which is not standard in some respects. So I can't tell you more rather than just use the 10% and then
you. It's only 2 points. If
beta is
large, you cannot say anything.
Yes. What
worries me?
Well, I would say that from some point of view, this point is the weakest part in this spectrum. But about this point, we know that this object is there, so we could actually play a trick by using the difference, and once you have found also the shape of the difference, take again the extrapolation of the radio, and then add the difference that you have found by using the spatial information. But this is some.
You got more points.
Yes, no.
Always true. Okay, is there another question?
Chris, a more general question. Do you support the notion that the radio emitting particles in crab are from the early spin down? I mean, do you see any reason why that shouldn't be?
Well, this could be, I mean, there is also, a person who tried to show that quantitatively very recently is Atoyan, and in order to show that, he has to make a lot of assumptions. So he need to have a pulsar spinning at about with an original spinning energy of 10^51 Hz, but that's not enough. Then he needs to kill the excess of magnetic field which has been produced. And in that case, it infers also a sort of interaction between magnetic field and particles, by which the magnetic field is feeding, is accelerating the particles by maintaining their original spectral distribution. So in the view of all this kind of requirement, I'm saying that probably this could be the case, but it's not just assuming, it's not just by assuming that the original spin of the pulsar was high that you can solve all the problems.
So the problem with magnetic energy is that the initial spin was long enough that it didn't forget its initial spin until relatively late in the game, when the adiabatic losses on the magnetic field would be relatively, would not be large enough.
Yes, in some way, in this some sense. But I would say that if there could have been a way for reaching quantitatively this result, Atoyan would have he should have found the result, because he was firmly trying to show that point. But at the end, he came out with requiring also this kind of macroscopic interaction between the magnetic field and the particles.
Let's thank Reno one more time.
Thank you.